You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review for the edition covering the 22nd to the 28th of August 2013. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove and Elizabeth Gibney, books editor Karen Shook and editor John Gill. Today we will be dissecting Clearing, looking at what the A-Level Results Day meant for universities looking to fill their places. Our cover feature asks quite simply, why are there so few female university vice-chancellors? We'll look at that too. We'll hear some of the highlights from this week's book section, along with news of our latest dedicated books podcast. And finally, we'll be asking how much work you do late at night and over the weekend. But first, both the lead news story and John, your editorial, are perhaps unsurprisingly on the theme of student recruitment following this year's A-Level Results Day.
And Clearing, yes, which of course is still underway. I think you have to wait some time until Clearing comes to an end, until we get a very clear picture of exactly what's happened and who the real winners and losers are in this. But overall, I think it's been a pretty positive year for universities. Our lead story this week picks up the theme of rising student numbers, and it looks as though we're on course for, if not a record year in terms of student recruitment, certainly something roughly on a par with 2011, which was the biggest year for student numbers so far. And this, of course, comes off the back of a dip last year with the introduction of tuition fees. So very positive, I think, for the sector as a whole.
Yeah, although on that lead story, which Jack, you wrote, obviously top grades in A-levels were down. There's fewer 18-year-olds in the population, and yet there's record recruitment, as John was just saying. How does that work? Are universities taking, you know, students that you could say have poorer results than previous years?
Well, this is the fear that some people think that, you know, you've got fewer applications, more people up, and the universities are maybe having to reach a little bit further down to students who they might not have had a look at in the past, and they're coming into the system. And obviously, I mean, there are some issues there. They're harder to teach, more expensive, and higher dropout rates as well. And also, people could say as well, you know, are there too many students? Although, what would those students be doing it otherwise?
I think you've got a hard job spinning this as a negative story for the sector.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty impressive. As someone says in Jack's feature, I think it's David Green at
Worcester
saying that this is a bloody nose for the anti-university lobby. You know, we just came after a period where there's been an awful lot of talk. I actually did a round of interviews on A-level results there on the BBC regional radio network, and I did about a dozen interviews, and in every single interview, one of the first questions was, you know, is university still worth it? Should students be bothering with university in this 9,000 fee era? And that's the kind of tone of the public debate, and has been for a few years. And I think really, if you look at these student numbers, that's a resounding answer to that, that people do think it's still worth it. And actually, Andy Westwood, who's chief executive of Guild HE, and formerly a special advisor to John Denham, so not a natural ally of the coalition government, kind of says in a quote in this story that, you know, politically, the coalition can really say that their fee reforms have come out pretty well in the second year, in that it doesn't seem to be affecting student numbers in any significant way.
And if you think about all the heat and all the political controversy we've had in the last 4 or 5 years about that, it was by no means taken for granted that student numbers were going to go up and the upward trend was going to continue.
So, I mean, that's not to say there aren't issues in all this, because of course the ABB cut-off, there's the potential for a cliff edge there. If some of the selective universities are no longer able to sort of reach down below ABB and take students with lower grades, how do you marry that with the call for, you know, extra use of contextual data in admissions, for example? Some of the kind of, if you look at the detail of some of the A-level results, languages are in big trouble. You know, the number of students taking French and German A-level fell by, I think, 10 and 11% respectively. The number of A-level university courses in modern languages is in decline. That's a really big issue for the country, I think, not just for higher education. And also, some of the universities that have expanded very dramatically, Exeter, for example, have announced very proudly, and rightly so, you know, they've played the market and they've won additional ABB students. They've expanded their intake by 600 students this year. well, and wonderful, that's great for Exeter because, you know, all the extra popularity and extra income and extra really, you know, high-achieving students that they're taking. On another level, that probably means that some other universities have missed out on those students. So this is the market working, and there will be losers as well as winners. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about that must pose challenges internally for Exeter too. You can't have rubber walls that just expand, you know, endlessly without there being either you need to, you know, look at class size and so on, or recruit more academics, or, you know, something's got to give on one level when you start to do that. So there's lots of issues here. It's not that, you know, these figures are kind of, you know, absolve the coalition of all sins or anything like that. But it's, there's definitely some positives, and, you know, it wasn't a foregone conclusion that student numbers would bounce back so impressively 1 year after the fee cap was raised.
Absolutely. Well, we will watch as that picture develops, and the Times Higher will, of course, keep you up to date as those stats update. Away from that topic for now, we have three articles in the magazine this week on the issue of female vice-chancellors, more specifically the lack of them. Ruth Farwell, who is VC at Buckinghamshire New University, writes about her experiences both in obtaining that job and carrying it out. Paula Birkinshaw, a Lancaster University doctoral candidate who organised the Missing Women in Higher Education Leadership Conference, has interviewed many of the 20 or so women who do lead UK higher education institutions. She writes about those discussions. And Jack, you kick off this special section with a report on some criticisms of what's called in the piece a sort of boys club in university senior management.
Well, I attended that conference up at Lancaster University, and it was very interesting. And there was a very impressive talk by Dame Julia King, who is Vice-Chancellor at Aston University. And she was, obviously, talking about the lack of female Vice-Chancellor, but also some of her experiences leading a university. And she's no sort of stranger to sort of male-dominated areas. She was an executive at Rolls-Royce and she has been in those environments, but she was saying that at university there is a sort of a certain culture that doesn't seem to accept women in the same ways it would do men. So, for instance, she and other senior women were described as frightening a lot, and this was a sort of a tag that was applied to her, and it tended not to be applied to men. So if a woman was sort of ordering you around and in a position of authority, she would be frightening, while a man who did it would be sort of imposing or, you know, assured, assertive. And so these might seem like little things, but they said they do grind you down after a while, these constant this discourse basically is and there's other things she mentioned as well. She was saying at her university, when she arrived, there wasn't really any pictures of women on the walls, it was all men. And I'm sure we've been to universities where there's lovely oil paintings going along these panelled quads and dining rooms, and they generally tend to be all be of men. So how does that make women feel when they arrive in there? And she was saying that she wanted to get different faces on the wall.
Change the culture.
I mean, there's more to it than just culture, isn't there? Because there is also the specific aspects of the academic career path which just make it very difficult for women, for example, to take a break to have a child and then come back and still find the same rung on the ladder in terms of research careers, which probably is the traditional route that a vice-chancellor will have come through. They'll have been a successful researcher before they hit the management level. And so there's a sort of double whammy here, isn't there, which is perhaps, you know, blocking out. And it's mad for institutions to sort of miss out on, you know, all the skills and talents that their female self have to offer at this senior level.
Yeah, but that was one issue where it was pointed out that if a woman goes off to have a child, that's seen as damaging to her career. But if a man has children, then that's actually seen as a sort of voting confidence in him as a person who's, you know, got a wife and a family, and that's all a good reflection on his...
It fits the stereotype.
Yeah, exactly. While for women, it's seen as something that's going to drag them down, while for a man, it's seen in totally the opposite way.
In fact, there's actually research that shows that men who have children, early career researchers, are granted tenure more readily after they have children. So it's seen as a positive. But of course, the same doesn't apply for women.
And I think it is important that we look at these kind of things, the more subtle cultural aspects as well as the practicalities, because that's one of the things where we think academia should be meritocratic, and a lot of people might think that doesn't apply in our sector like it might do in the big scary world of business. But as we can see from this article, it most certainly does.
Mm. There's a certain amount of complacency, I think, because universities see themselves as being progressive places where it's the quality of your ideas that matter.
And it was interesting to hear Dame Julia King, who is a very formidable woman. She's, you know,
had a great... frightening, though?
She wasn't frightening, but she had a great presence and she had a great authority about her. But she was saying that even she sometimes feels when she walks into a room and she's the only woman in the room, everyone else is wearing grey suits and she's wearing a pink jacket. She do tend to stand out a bit and you know, she's obviously comfortable doing that, but other women might feel that they don't sort of, you know, it's harder for them to step forward and make their voices heard, because obviously they're going to stand out a little bit more.
Makes me think of Sally Davies saying that in this week's Week in HE, Dame Sally Davies talking about women suffering from self-doubting imposter syndrome, but men carry a confidence-giving bullshit gene.
Not one of us.
It's a technical term.
Well, this is an issue that Times Higher has been covering in quite some depth over recent months. We had our Global Gender Index, which is worth checking out in our new data section on our website, which has all the data sets that we've gathered over the years in one place. But we'll leave it there for now and head over to Karen with news of the latest books section and a special books podcast, which I believe will be out tomorrow, Friday.
That's right. I love my book section every week. This week is particularly lovable. We have Mary Bryden looking at Christopher Prendergast on Proust and whether it really mattered if it was a madeleine or some other kind of pastry. Eric Jan Bose talks about Stephen Nadler's new look at René Descartes and whether who painted the famous picture of René Descartes. And Chris Pearson considers Colin Crouch's quest to reform capitalism. But the real delight of this week and my guest in the studio tomorrow with our books podcast is Richard J. Williams, who's Professor of Contemporary Visual Cultures at the University of Edinburgh, the lovely and refined Edinburgh. Richard Williams decided, as a scholar but also as an Edinburghian, could that be correct?
Is that right?
There was something about, well, he's a Manc, he's actually. He said there's something about Edinburgh that makes people sexually frustrated, and his neighbourhood in particular. So taking the idea of personal research to heart, he decided to go find out where there are buildings that are erotic.
Right.
He does mention the Gherkin, of course. He could have stayed in London, but his preference was for mid-century modern. He went to Los Angeles and looked at a bunch of iconic buildings, but most deliciously, he stopped off in Ypsilanti, Michigan, where the world's most phallic building resides. It's a water tower known as the Brick Dick.
Is that official? That is the world's most phallic building.
it won a poll in a very witty magazine. So Richard Williams talks to me about the search for the way that whether you can actually find buildings that are informed by sexuality. He tells a great story about going down to Brazil, which is an area that he has research interests in, and talking to Oscar Niemeyer, who, of course, is the great modernist architect who is responsible for many of the most iconic buildings in Brazil. Oscar, getting on in years, glad to talk about architecture, but much more interested in talking about beautiful women. And, in fact, did some sketches for Richard Williams, all of the gorgeous women of Brazil.
Fantastic. Well, do check that out, and indeed check that section out every week. And the books series of podcasts is available online. I think this is number 6 now in the series, so do.
And the sexiest.
And by far
the sexiest.
I've always thought Edinburgh was a beautiful city, but I wasn't sure.
Apparently, it's quite repressed.
Maybe that says more about me than I care to read into. Finally, Lizzie, researchers have long lamented that they have to work late into the night, and indeed over the weekend. We've found that on our Twitter account, frequently asking with our hashtag HEWeekend what people have been up to in their spare time that should have been confined to office hours. you've got some evidence to back this up.
Yeah, well, that's why I thought this was particularly interesting, because for once we actually have some figures behind this commonly held belief. So what this study did was it looked at when papers were submitted to one particular journal. So it's in the field of conservation biology, and is looking at both manuscripts and review papers. And it can do that because obviously it's all electronic now. So this is something we wouldn't have been able to do a few years back. And it found that a remarkably high number are submitted outside of normal working hours. And given that normal working hours here is also 7 a.m. till 7 p.m., it's hardly being particularly generous in the first place. So it found that I think worldwide about a quarter were submitted outside of what we might consider to be normal hours. Mm. And there was a big difference between different areas of the world as well. We've got some stats on the UK, and there were considerable numbers still. I think 9% of manuscripts were submitted at weekends. But that was nothing compared to in China and India and Japan, where the levels were even higher. And obviously this study took into account differences in time zones and working weeks and things. So I think it adds a little bit of evidence to that. And then obviously it raises questions such as, does this have an effect on the research itself? Should we be looking at whether it affects the quality? And obviously, going back to the discussion previously about women in research, you know, family life can only be hindered by the fact that people are working in, late into the night and at weekends.
No, it's interesting stuff. There's loads more in this week that I wanted to talk about.
Well, one thing that would be worth mentioning actually is Laura, a special edition of Laurie Taylor's Poppletonian, because he's done the first of what will be three postcards home from various members of Poppleton University from their summer holidays. And it's really, you shouldn't miss it. This week is Gordon Lapping holidaying in Venice, and the brilliant illustration that goes with it too, so do have a look at that.
No, indeed. And you can follow the University of Poppleton on Twitter now as well, Uni of Poppleton. And they send
out... How are they doing in clearing?
There is actually an article about their approach to clearing that leaves very little to the imagination, and you should check out that Twitter feed for a link to that very one. But that's all for this week's issue review. A few things to flag up. We've got an ongoing offer, 12 issues of the Times Higher for £12, our summer promotion. There's a link on the homepage to that. You can't really say fairer than that, can you? The Best University Workplace Survey is still open until the end of this month. That's the end of August. Again, there's a link on the homepage. We've had several thousand responses already, but we do want more. The more we get, the better the data. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, and of course at timeshighereducation.co.uk. But that's the end of this week's Times Higher Education Issue Review Podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.